Welcome to Bird News. I'm Mindy Todd, along with ornithologist Vernon Locks. Morning, Vern.
Good morning, Mindy.
What a gorgeous day.
It is outrageous out there. Yep. Now, I think this is the nicest day we've had this fall so far.
And, of course, a lot of the birds are migrating. So you were at, what, Peterson Farm this morning?
I was. Of course, the radio show has to be on, like, the nicest morning when there's birds everywhere. Peterson Farm is just up the road in Woods Hole here, and it's a beautiful big woodland surrounded with a field in the middle, and there were lots of migrant birds there this morning. I was just there for a little while, and I had a couple of red-eyed vireos, chestnut-sided warbler, blue-gray gnatcatchers, two eastern wood peewees, an eastern phoebe, a couple of bobolinks flew over.
So wow.
And all these birds actually were migrating probably last night, and they dropped in here this morning. They'll be feeding. That west wind last night blew them from – maybe they were in northern Maine last night. Maybe they were in southern Quebec. Mm. It's just a great time of year.
What's interesting, too, about Peterson Farm, and I remember I think it was last year we were there, and you talk about it being like this highway, and you watch, and the birds that come down and then they hit the water, some of them don't like the water. They turn around and go back the other way.
Well, yep. If you had a satellite shot, or you go on Google Earth and fly into Woods Hole and Falmouth, look at the shape of the land. So any bird that was airborne last night and started to turn, they want to follow the immediate coastline. And, of course, the coast here keeps curving, going west and west and south. The birds come out. Anyway, if there's a funneling point right down, and Peterson Farm is almost the tip of the funnel. And then they get down by the Steamship Authority in Woods Hole, and they see the Elizabeth Islands, but they see the water, and they don't know what to do. So they start circling. They go up in the air. And they look and they look, and either they chicken out and they come back into the trees for the day, or they go up and they drop to the west and they keep moving. The same thing happens at the west end of Martha's Vineyard at the Gay Head Cliffs. It happens at Mattaquit on Nantucket. Cuddy Hunk is fantastic for it. There's a little gooseberry neck over, and there's a lot of places that are little funneling points for the birds.
Well, when people find an injured bird at the beach or in their yard, they often don't know where to turn for help. Sometimes a bird may only appear to be hurt, but often the injuries are life-threatening, and many of these birds end up at the Wild Care Center in Eastham, where wildlife rehabilitators work to treat their injuries and ultimately release the birds back into the wild. And our Outer Cape correspondent Brian Morris paid a visit to Wild Care and has this report.
Wild Care's property sits smack at the edge of the Orleans Rotary. The whoosh of passing cars and trucks creates a constant background din. This may seem an odd location for a wildlife hospital, but Executive Director Stephanie Ellis says they've been here 7 years and the property is ideal.
I think this location was chosen because of the large barn, and there's quite a bit of space in the house, and then we were able to add aviaries to the property, and it abuts conservation land.
And that means many rehabilitated birds can be released right back into this wild habitat once they're healthy enough. Inside the yellow barn, two cages sit on a wooden counter. One holds an injured juvenile robin and the other a group of Carolina wrens. These birds aren't healthy enough to feed on their own yet, so a volunteer uses a feeding syringe to give them a nutritional meal every 20 minutes. Attached to the cages are cage cards, which provide information about the bird's condition and nature of injury.
And this says that mother bird made a nest in the mailbox, mother was killed, and no birds returned to the nest. So these birds were orphaned, and they're doing very, very well.
When people find orphaned, sick, or injured birds, their first instinct is often to seek help. Part of Wild Care's mission is to educate the public about when a rescue is needed and when it's not.
We encourage people, if they find a nest of birds on the ground, depending on the scenario, we might encourage them to put the birds into a basket and hang it back into the tree, you know, and wait for the parents to return. So I feel like we do a lot of prevention as well, trying to prevent animals from coming in when they don't have to.
Right next to the barn is a large, brown, elliptically shaped building. It's a raptor aviary, the largest of its kind in New England. The unique structure has an outer shell, which creates an open, more or less circular space between the outer wall and the interior of the building.
It allows for a bird to have continuous flight. So it's much more natural. We have a great horned owl in here, and we can encourage this bird to fly around 5 laps, 10 laps. It's much more natural than just flying back and forth in a rectangular-shaped aviary.
This is very cool.
Isn't this amazing? Well, the bird you'll see as we walk around, he is actually loose in here. Oh. So we'll stay to the sidelines here. Great horned owls are big birds.
This particular bird has a fractured humerus of the wing.
With great horned owls, you want their flight to be absolutely silent. And so this bird, as you see when I make him go around, he's not quite there yet. We're working on it. We're hoping as he gains strength that his flight will become a little more silent. We'll eventually see him around the corner here.
Mm-hmm. There he is. Wow.
There we go. Yeah, an absolute beauty. Gorgeous, gorgeous bird.
The great horned owl sits on a far perch. It fixes us immediately with a suspicious gaze and never takes its eyes off us for a second.
If we stay to the side, we can ask him to fly.
Do you think he will?
Mm-hmm.
With a little coaxing from Stephanie, the impressive bird lifts off its perch and takes flight, circling around the aviary.
Give the owl his space here. Oh, there he is. He's right there. He just took off.
Oh.
It disappears for a few seconds, and then...
Here he comes. Whoa!
We leave the great horned owl to its flight and head over to WildCare's main building. Here, wildlife rehabilitator Alex Mueller tends to a loon which was brought in with a respiratory infection. It's one of four she's currently caring for.
This one has been here since the 8th of August, and she's kind of on the final leg of her journey at WildCare. We've solved most of the problems. She's still on antibiotics for the respiratory infection, but right now the most important thing, in fact for all three of these loons, is their waterproofing, which is terrible.
Alex says that when a seabird is injured, it often neglects to waterproof its feathers, which is vital to their survival. Loons have a special gland at the base of their tail.
And that produces a special oil. Like the phrase, water off of a duck's back, that's the water sort of beams off because their feathers are oiled in this special bird oil that keeps the water sealed out.
Mueller says the most important aspect of bringing a loon back to health is getting it to preen, which they often stop doing when they're sick. She says there's a human parallel.
If you're feeling sick, you're not really going to care about your personal appearance, and that's what happens to them as well. If they're feeling tired and they're wet, they usually just beach themselves and kind of sleep on the beach, and they stop preening and they stop doing normal behavioral things, so that's how their feather condition kind of torpedoes. So when they're here and they feel healthy and they're feeling good, we encourage them by swimming them, forcing them to swim in the pool even though they get wet. Once they come out, we stick heat lamps on them and they start preening like they're, you know, sitting on the sun. And it's like an artificial way to jumpstart them to preen a whole lot more than they ordinarily would.
Across the lawn are two smaller aviaries that look like oversized sheds. In one, a group of cedar waxwings flap about with several robins. These birds are much healthier than the birds in the barn. They're feeding on their own, bickering with one another, flitting about, and generally behaving the way birds should. Stephanie Ellis says it's almost time for them to be released.
And if you can see that little hatch door that the robin's sitting on, we just open that up, and then we put food outside for these birds. So they'll be able to feed on the foods that they had here, and then basically disperse on their own.
For all the care that Ellis and her staff provide, they know that here is not where these wrens, owls, and cedar waxwings belong. Their natural home is in the wild, and the healing process is never complete until the birds are once again able to survive there. For Bird News, I'm Brian Morris in Eastham.
And WildCare will be hosting Birds, Beds, and Breakfast November 8th through the 10th, and we have a link on our website for more information, capeandislands.org. Click on Bird News. WildCare is not the only wildlife rehabilitation center on the Cape. We have the Cape Wildlife Center, operated by the Humane Society in partnership with the Fund for Animals. It's located in Barnstable. And joining us on the phone from the Cape Wildlife Center is staff veterinarian Roberto Aguilar. Good morning, Dr. Aguilar.
Good morning. Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, sure. So was it a busy summer for you?
It was. It was that. We see about 1,500 animals a year, between 1,500 and 2,000. And it was a busy summer. About 60% of that are birds. And we didn't see quite as many orphans as we have in the past, but we did see quite a few other incidental birds came in.
Yeah, and I think you have a story about a Canada goose?
That's correct. Yeah, this is a banded goose, so we know it's where it came from. It was banded last year, and it's a male. but it came in severely lead poisoned. And when animals are lead poisoned, they become extremely debilitated. In birds, it's more dramatic because they grind this lead continuously and are able to absorb it continuously. So it's even more prolonged and worse than in other, you know, species. Mm. But this, these animals come in with such severe weakness that their heads are on the back of their on their backs, and their wings droop to the ground.
Oh, wow. So where do they get the lead from?
Oh, it's incredible, but there's so much lead in the environment because people still use it for sinkers, and there's a limit to the amount of lead you can use in Massachusetts, but many states still allow it.
Wow.
It's shot, spent shot, rifle shot, or sinkers and other forms of pure lead that are left in the environment. These animals will scoop it from the bottom of ponds or eat it accidentally.
They may. Hi, Roberto. It's Vern.
Good morning, Vern.
You know, but since birds don't have teeth, mm-hmm. unlike us, they, you know, they have their crop and they have to ingest. They're often eating stuff off the bottom. Like tree swallows right now are eating sand to digest the bayberries, and I think loons and geese and stuff. They're constantly, if they, you know, a shiny little lead ball on the bottom of the pond looks like, oh, that's going to be great to grind mm-hmm. up my food, and they ingest it, and then what you're describing, that so the birds are actually taking that lead and it gets into their system and poisons them and kills them.
Yeah. So what I'm hoping this has a happy ending. How's this goose doing?
It's doing great. Yeah. The process is called chelation. It's a lot like chemotherapy.
Oh, wow.
And you have to give them a substance that binds the lead and allows them to eliminate it. But it has to be given for 5 days on, 2 days off for several cycles. So a single animal can spend months in recuperation.
Wow. Yeah. So I wonder, you know, we heard in the last story and with you as well that once these birds are rehabilitated, that they're returned to the wild. But I know there are times when a bird can't be returned to the wild. What happens to those birds?
Well, it depends on the situation. For example, if it's a migratory bird and the migration is passed, we have agreements sometimes with airlines that will ship them for free and send them somewhere where they can catch up with migration. In other cases, if they're a unique animal that is reproductively valuable, like an oyster catcher, there may be aquaria or zoos that we may be able to place them in, but for specific programs. Mm-hmm. And most of these animals are protected. Some are extremely rare.
Yeah. So, like, if say, an owl has a broken wing that doesn't heal, right, it can't fly, does it just stay for the rest of its life at your wildlife center? Or?
No, we can't.
You can't. I was going to say, yeah.
But, yeah, we may find a place for it. And the state has lists of people who or groups that are authorized and are, you know, you have to have licenses and permits for these things.
Right.
But many go to education programs and other places. In our case, we don't necessarily just place them because we don't want the animal to suffer or be mistreated. So we have very specific guidelines as to where an animal can go.
Wow. I know, Dr. Aguilar, that you have a tremendous amount of experience rehabilitating raptors, hawks, and owls. And I know personally, living on Nantucket, I have sent you probably a dozen injured birds over the last few years. And you've done I think it's so amazing. We send you a bird. And, of course, unlike it's nice if you can contribute, but these places are actually taking the birds and they do all this work. And basically it's through their generous, you know, mm-hmm. through donations that it works. I think the Cape is really lucky to have a place like this. And I'm just amazed when you get the birds, you send me the x-rays of the stomach. It's like it's unbelievable how high tech and what you're able to fix. I thought some of the birds I sent you were not going to make it. And you have nursed them back to health. So I just wanted to congratulate you for doing such a fine job.
Thank you, Vern. And I remember there's a harrier that you complained you couldn't even photograph because it busted out of that box so fast and took off. You couldn't even get a photograph of it.
I particularly like it when you send me back a healthy bird that I get to let go. That's terrific. Okay. And you know, it's just we're lucky that you're there.
Yeah. So is this the goose that's got the lead poisoning? Is that the most unusual case you had this summer?
No, we've had a lot of cases that are unusual. We had a puffin come in. And those animals are in dire straits.
Oh.
The entire puffin population is suffering because we think, and I don't know if Vern can correct me on this, but due to changes in the water temperature and changes in fish availability.
Mm. Right. They're, instead of the stuff they were eating now, the water temperature has changed, and now their butterfish are more common. And the puffins, the adults, bring the butterfish into the burrow, and the chicks can't swallow them because the butterfish are too wide. So even though there's plenty of fish, the chicks are starving.
Yeah, what did they used to eat?
They used to eat like sardines and sand eels and different fish that has now moved further north because the water temperatures have risen slightly.
Yeah, wow.
So it's a problem.
I'm sorry. One of the stories, the most interesting bird we had was a pelican. And this was a brown pelican blown up here by Sandy.
Oh, wow.
And it was banded. So when we had it here, I contacted the feds, you know, to let them know, the federal agents, that we had this bird. And they thought I'd been drinking. I had seen a pelican. I had to send them pictures. I know what a pelican looks like. I worked in Louisiana for many years. But they didn't believe it. And they wouldn't believe it. They finally accepted the fact that we had a pelican here. There were 12 pelicans, I believe, in the state after
Sandy.
Wow.
Yeah. And so did that pelican end up going back? Did you ship it back south after?
Yes, we had to ship it back south.
And I remember I think the first bird I was ever involved with sending to you was Freddie the Fulmar.
Correct.
The dark Fulmar that was picked up by the hospital on Nantucket. And we sent it over and they had it. Roberto had it for three months, I think. And
that's correct.
They tripled the body weight. They got it waterproof again. And then we brought it back and had a big Freddie the Fulmar release party, was a big hit on Nantucket. That was good.
One thing I need to mention, Vern, is that these aren't just releases like out your backyard. You took them out in a boat. And you released them.
Right.
That's true. When we released Freddie, it was blowing 50 miles an hour. And my boat's only 16 feet long. but it was it was still fun and nice and The Fulmar went back to his, hopefully, out to the open ocean.
All right. Veterinarian Roberto Aguilar with the Cape Wildlife Center. Thanks for joining us this morning. Appreciate
your
time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's Bird News. We're talking birds. And if you have a bird story question for us, give us a call. 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is birdnews@capeandislands.org. And we mentioned oyster catchers in there a minute ago. So we want to bring on shorebird expert Edie Ray on Nantucket, who's going to tell us a little bit about an oyster catcher program that's happening there. Morning, Edie.
Good morning. How are you guys?
Great.
Perfect.
I love these oyster catchers. They're so pretty.
It's hard not to like an oyster catcher.
Yeah. So what's going on with them? You've got some sort of a banding program? What's the program?
Yeah. Well, out here on Nantucket, there's been a banding program for oyster catchers since 2005. And these bands consist of what's called a field-readable band. That is a band that has letters and numbers on it that, with a good pair of binoculars, you can actually read what it says on the band. And that's unlike the little silver bands that you see on some birds that have tiny little letters and numbers on them that you have to basically hold it in your hand in order to read the code on there and find out who that bird is, just like they were talking about the pelican that had banded. Mm-hmm. You would have to catch that bird to actually read those little numbers on there. But on the oyster catchers, because they're sort of big birds, we can put a fairly large band on it with a code, and it's an individual code, so that if I see a bird that's like E2, I can look up and know exactly where that bird was banded, and I can then know the history of it.
Wow. So this has been going on a couple years now, you say?
Oh, yeah, since 2005 on Nantucket, and before that in other spots.
Yeah.
And what's really cool about this, Mindy, is that we can actually track these birds without sort of interfering in their lives.
Wow.
Because we can see them from a distance, we can see where E2 has nested, where it's raising its chicks, and then oyster catchers, like many other birds you guys are talking about today, are migrating, getting ready to migrate. So we can find out where that bird goes along its way down to Florida, which is where a lot of the Cape and Islands oyster catchers like to spend the winter.
Wow.
Pretty smart.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah. So how many do you think you've banded in this program so far? I mean, is it like hundreds?
Quite a few, actually. This year, I think we're up to about 23. Mm-hmm. Some years, we'll band 30. And these are very long. These birds live quite a long time. So, you know, over 10 or 12 years of tracking these birds, we're able to really learn an awful lot about where they go and what they do. This time of year, it's really fun, at least for us bird geeks, because we're out on the beaches with optics looking for these birds. And, you know, we're seeing birds now that have nested over on Monomoy National Wildlife Refuge starting to do what's called staging here on Nantucket, where they sort of gather in these flocks of 10, 12, 15, 20 oyster catchers. And they're from all over the Cape and the Islands.
Huh.
And then they'll head south. They might make a stop in New York somewhere, in New Jersey. And they'll be tracked along their way. And through that, we've learned that a lot of our sort of Nantucket, well, we consider them our birds, but they're only here really for a short part of the year, like to go to a place called Cedar Key, which is north of Tampa on the west coast of Florida. So if any of you snowbirds are listening and you're down in that area, look for some of our yellow-banded oyster catchers down there, because you might see some of your friends from Cape Cod down there.
Also sounds like a good time to just, as they're staging, that's a good chance to see a group of them together. So they're going on a group trip.
Absolutely, and it's really interesting to see the interactions, because during the breeding season, oyster catchers, like many other birds, are extremely territorial, and they'll, like, you know, fly and squawk at any other oyster catcher that comes into their space. This time of year, they're not territorial, and they're grouping up their in areas where there's available food and places for them to rest. And it's the resting part is really, really important, because, I mean, imagine the journey from Cape Cod and the islands all the way down to the west coast of Florida. And then think about driving that distance without stopping for food or fuel. And for these birds, their food is their fuel. So it's important to protect these birds where they're nesting, but also to protect these staging or rest stops, if you will, along the way from point A to point B.
And they're really lucky they don't have to drive down 95 the whole way.
Oh, my God. Can you imagine getting through New York?
So you said they live a long time. How long do they live?
I think oyster catchers can live, I don't know, maybe 15 years or so. I'm not sure what the oldest oyster catcher is. But each year they nest, they lay three eggs. If it's a really good season and they're really expert parents, they can raise all three chicks. Normally they don't raise that many, unfortunately. And we try to band as many of those youngsters as possible before they can fly. And what we're finding is 2-year-old birds are starting to come back now. We're seeing some birds we banded, you know, 2 years ago, that are coming back and kind of hanging out for the summer, like typical teenagers hanging out at the beach. And next year, when they're three, they'll start coming back and looking for their own space and starting a family here.
Wow.
American oyster catchers are very different than other shorebirds as well, because most shorebirds are what's called precocial. So like when a baby piping plover hatches, it pops up out of the egg, and within about 10 minutes, it's like this fully feathered little puffball with toothpicks. It's running around and it finds its own food. The adults never feed it. Oyster catchers are what's called sort of semi-precocial. The oyster catcher adults will actually not only protect the young, but they feed it, and they bring it clams and worms, and they actually have to show them how to catch, because oyster catchers, they don't really eat oysters, but they do eat lots of shellfish, bivalves. They have like the world's most colorful shucking knife for a bill. And the adults actually show them how to work. They show them how to open the clams.
Wow.
And because of this, they have a much greater success rate at raising young than other shorebirds. And they're also fierce in defense of the young. I have seen them get on the back of a great black-backed gull and start pounding them with this big orange bill, pulling off feathers. And that's one reason that oyster catchers are doing so well. And they keep moving further north every year. They're actually nesting in Nova Scotia now. John James Audubon claims to have seen them up in Newfoundland, and apparently oyster catchers are doing better than they have since the mid-1800s, which is great.
Edie Ray, shorebird expert. Thanks for joining us, Edie.
Oh, can I say one more
thing? Yeah, go ahead. Sure.
Oyster catcher fans out there, if you go online on AMOYWG, that's American Oyster Catcher Working Group .org, you will learn everything you ever might want to know about oyster catchers and more. And also, there's a place there to report banded birds if you happen to find them.
All right, tell us that one more time. It's what?
AMOYWG.org.
Okay, we'll put a link up on our website.
American Oyster Catcher Working
Group. Great.
Well, we'll get on the website that link, and also maybe some photographs of some of the banded, of the color banded oyster catchers, so people can see what they look like.
Beautiful birds, beautiful birds.
Thank you guys.
Thanks a lot, Edie.
For joining us.
It's
Bird News with ornithologist Vernon Locks, and I'm Indy Todd. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. I'm Indy Todd, along with ornithologist Vernon Locks, and we are talking birds. If you have a bird question, bird story, give us a call, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is birdnews@capeandislands.org. Edie mentioned Monomoy. We recently did a little trip over there and saw some great birds. We had the perfect day. I think we had the absolute perfect day of the summer for that.
We actually had a big trip tomorrow morning. That was we actually went from Nantucket and went roaring across Nantucket Sound and up the outside, the outer beach, the east side of Monomoy Island, which is one of the most spectacular beaches in the world, actually. And, you know, with gray seals. That's the great white sharks liked it over there, but not so much this summer.
We did see the ship, the Oceana, that was looking for the sharks in the plane, but we didn't see any sharks.
No, they only were able to catch two all summer, and they were hoping to get like 30. And I think there's something going on with the sharks that they know, hey, once they caught a couple, I mean, they're sending some electrical signals. All the sharks left.
No, I think it's a bait they're using. They're not using seal. You can't.
I don't know. But anyway, I thought that was pretty interesting.
But yeah, we saw. So talk about some of the birds we saw.
Well, it was fantastic. We had a perfect day. This was, 2 weeks ago?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, we went up first. We went to the north end, South Beach. We went through the new inlet, which was amazing. And we got there at high tide, and there were thousands of shorebirds.
Oh, my gosh.
Thousands of terns. We had a marbled godwit. We had a couple of Arctic terns. We just had the thing about going there is you see more birds in a short period of time. I tell people on Nantucket, you know what? You should go over to Monomoy Island because in 4 hours on Monomoy, you'll see more birds than you'll see in 10 years on Nantucket. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's true. So you look at all the red knots and the short-billed dowitchers and
black
sanderlings. And all of a sudden, things that you were maybe having trouble with because you don't see them very often,
right.
It all starts making sense. And you can start, oh, wow, I really do see the difference in that bird.
Yeah.
And then we went around the north end of the island and up into Nantucket Sound and went down to the south end of Monomoy, which Monomoy used to be, back in the 1800s, there was a village down on the south end, a place called the Powder Hole. Now, of course, it's a wilderness area, and there's nobody lives there. There's still a lighthouse near the south end. But there's some ponds down there, and it's very undisturbed, very hard to get to, and it's fantastic for birds. So.
I like the laughing gull. I don't know why I like them so much, but I like them.
Well, they make funny noises. They laugh. It's all good.
All right, we got some people calling in. Joel's calling from Brewster. Hi, Joel.
Hi. I want to ask about a raptor. It's been around here, and when he's making his sound like a scree, you know, like they do, this one goes up instead of down. It seems to me most of them go down at the end. This one goes up. But he'll sit in a tree and just repeat that over and over and over again for 15 or 20 minutes as if he's crying for help or something like that. But then you see him flying around. He's still doing it. From underneath, I can't get a good...
So you weren't trying to figure out what it is, Joel?
Tree, but he looks all white underneath, and that's a spitting image of a northern goshawk, according to my book, which they say is rare.
Vern's shaking his head. So what do you think it is, Vern? Any thoughts?
Well, most young hawks, it sounds like you've got a young, I would guess, that a young red-tailed hawk would be. It could also be a Cooper's hawk. A lot of young birds, even some of the adults at this time of year, scream and make a high-pitched, shrill noise. Some go up, some go down. Their calls are not that distinctive when they're just doing that note because even blue jays can imitate. A lot of times a blue jay will call and I'll think it's a hawk, but he's imitating the call of a red-tailed hawk or something. A northern goshawk on the Cape is an adult bird is not happening.
Yeah.
That's extremely rare. Even in the winter, there's maybe one every 10 years, and it certainly wouldn't be here in early September.
So. All right. Dick is calling from Wellfleet. Hi, Dick.
Hi. I've got a seagull question.
Sure.
A seagull question. What's a seagull?
Isn't that pretty rare? We saw yesterday out in front of our house, there's a little marsh on Wellfleet Harbor, and these seagulls sort of flocked up and started flying up in the air and appeared to be eating insects. First the swallows came, then the seagulls came and sort of chased the swallows away and maybe spent 45 minutes fluttering around, chasing insects.
Was this near? Was it near sunset?
Yes.
Yeah.
And these gulls come just at this time of year, I believe. They're not the normal gulls that we see around the Wellfleet Harbor, I believe. Anyway, they're sort of medium-sized, muted colors, kind of.
You're very observant.
So what's going on?
Short tail, Short tails.
Yeah, no, what you were seeing was that it was either a hatch of termites or flying ants. When the males get wings, they're very big and they're very slow. And those were mostly immature laughing gulls, which Mindy was just talking about. They were small. They're much smaller than our herring and great blackback gulls. And they come in big flocks at this time of year and congregate. And they love to do nothing better when there's a big hatch of ants or termites. It's like a flying buffet out there because the bugs are really slow and clumsy, and they'll eat like crazy. And you normally both those insects wait till very late in the day, just before dark, when they hatch, because they are extremely vulnerable to avian predators. The swallows, everybody makes short work of them. So the only chance for the insects is to overwhelm them with numbers, because a lot of them are going to get eaten. Mm. And anyway, that's what you were seeing, and that's always one of my favorite things to see. I haven't seen it this year, so I congratulate you. I can't wait. I wish I'd been there.
Yeah.
It was a lot of fun, and I appreciate because the immatures are often hard to identify. But we do have a lot of laughing gulls in this area, and that's a great answer. Yeah. Thank you,
Dick. Thanks for the question. Yep.
The young laughers look like a young. They look like a Jaeger almost. They're much more. They have a dark chest, and they're much more acrobatic than the larger gulls. So.
Dick, thanks for the phone call. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is birdnews@capeandislands.org. And Joan is calling from Harwich. Hi, Joan.
Good morning.
It is.
About a month ago, I have a little lemon tree on the deck, and it had baby lemons on it. And I came down one morning, and there was an oriole pecking away at them, so I chased the oriole and I put a bird netting over it. And 2 weeks ago came down and I had caught a little tufted titmouse. So I went out and tried to extract it, but it had its head caught, so I got blunt scissors and cut it free. And the poor thing, I don't know how long it had been there, but it was in the sun. And it laid my hand puffing and panting and just trembling. So I put it in a shady spot on the deck in a planter and put some water by it and left it alone. And about an hour later, I went out to check on it because I could see it from inside the house. I could see it was still moving. And when I got out there, it was sitting up. It had been laying when I put it down in the planter in the first place. It just tipped over onto its chest. And it was sitting up and looking a bit alert. So I went away and left it alone and then came back a while later and it was gone. So the reason I thought about taking it down to wild care, but a couple of times I've taken birds down to wild care and they died in the car going down,
boy.
I think from stress.
Yeah.
So,
well, luckily this one had a happy ending.
It might do okay.
Yeah.
The dangers of bird nets, I guess, right?
I actually, if you have a little lemon tree, I would have sacrifice the lemons to keep the oriole there and just go to the store and buy lemons. I like that was great. I've never heard of an oriole going after lemons before. They love fruits and citrus, and that's pretty
these cool. Were little lemons. These had just started to form. Mm-hmm. So it probably might have thought they were berries or something.
Yeah. Well, that's pretty neat.
Well, John, we're glad the titmouse made it. Thanks for calling with your story. Appreciate it. Jerry is calling from McCoit. Hi, Jerry.
Hi. I hate to bother you, but everybody that has seen these birds keep asking me, have you ever found out what those birds are? My husband sent a picture to Vernon of them a couple of months ago. They've been at a thistle feeder practically every day until the last couple of weeks. And they look like cardinals, but they're bigger than cardinals. They have black heads. Black, shiny heads and long, long tails. And we think they may be. We've looked in every book that we have, and we just can't find them.
Jerry, if you sent me the pictures, did I respond? Because whenever someone sends me photos, I always answer them back about what the bird is. You didn't hear back from me?
No, we didn't. Mm-hmm.
Well,
I guess I didn't get
the photos. But what I think you're describing, I'm quite certain, is you're talking about northern cardinals that have lost the feathers on their head. For some reason, it's been happening.
Everybody that I know, he sent a note to the Bird Club of Cape Cod,
mm-hmm.
and that's what they said they were. But everybody that we told that, they said, oh, no, it couldn't be.
It could be.
They're much bigger than cardinals. They're ugly, actually.
I think, Jerry, why don't you try sending the photos again?
In this case, the photo's worth 10,000 words.
Yeah, we need the photos.
I should be able to tell.
Yeah, Jerry, send the photos to us here at the radio station.
For some reason, a lot of the cardinals get this fungus or something. They lose the feathers on their head at this time of year. And they look really funny. They look like little vulture cardinals with bald heads, and their skin is black. So it looks like they have a black head.
866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. Bird brain quiz this week. You know, birders often use mnemonics to help them remember bird songs. So here's an example from Edith Andrews, a birder on Nantucket.
White-throated sparrow, old Sam, Peabody, Peabody, Peabody. That's an easy one. Yeah. Oh, the warbling vireo is, if I see it, I will seize it, and I'll squeeze it till it squirts. I wish I knew who said, whoops, three beers. That'll come to me.
Okay, that's our question this month. What bird has the song mnemonic, whoops, three beers? I think you know. We'll give you the answer in a little bit.
When I learned that bird call, they used to say, quick, three beers.
Okay, so quick, whoops, three beers. Yeah. All right. Mike is calling from Woods Hole. Hi, Mike. Mike, are you there?
Hello.
Hi.
Hey, so I've been taking photos of birds here in Barnstable County since May. Mm-hmm. Jenny over there has been sharing some of my photos on Facebook.
Right.
Cool.
And I've seen 126 birds up to this point in Barnstable County. And I've pretty much seen all the ones that I'm going to, you know, see every day on a without going to see the bird. But there's a couple birds left that, if I want to see them, I'm going to have to go find them. One in particular is American bittern. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering what Vern could tell me about American bitterns and what's a good time to go look for them and where to look for them and what he knows about them.
American bitterns, I know a lot about them. they're kind of hard to find on the Cape, but they are coming through right now. I know there were two seen in Nauset Marsh last week. There's been a couple. They nest up in northern bogs, and then they migrate here. They're in some of our Barnstable Harbor, Barnstable Marsh, the Great Marsh. Nauset is good. Actually, if you're in Woods Hole, Sipawisset Marsh is also very good for bitterns. Of course, bitterns are really secretive, and they don't fly. Usually you see them when they fly. But if you can find one on the ground, a bittern's typical modus operandi is they'll freeze when you see them. And if you can spot them, sometimes you can walk up fairly close and take a picture of them, you know, roosting or frozen in the cattails. Basically, you've got to be lucky, but the best time to really find them is October and early November. And if you've got all of Barnstable County, I would suggest the marshes, Nauset Marsh, you know where Fort Hill and East Ham is? If you go there at a very high tide, either early or late in the day when the light's better for taking pictures, there are usually there's a few bitterns out in that marsh somewhere. But Barnstable Harbor, there's Meadow Lane or Navigation Road off Route 6A going out into Barnstable Marsh. Go down there at a high tide and walk the edge of the marsh, and you stand a really good chance of finding an American bittern.
Yeah.
So,
Mike, how long have you been birding? Are you new to? I know you've put a lot of photos up on our Facebook page.
I called you guys back in May, I think it was, mm-hmm. May Bird News, and I asked about sparrows because I was having trouble distinguishing all of the generic gray-brown birds out there. I'm much better at that now.
Mm-hmm.
But since then, I've become quite the avid birder, and I've been out, you know, at least three times a week.
Nice.
Going to, like, the Crane Wildlife Area.
Great.
And Sipawisset, like Vern said, and a lot of I haven't been down to the Chatham area of the Cape. I know there's a lot of shorebirds I need to add to my list.
Yeah.
But there was another one is the bald eagle, and I've never seen a bald eagle in my life. And I would, you know, I know that they come here. They don't nest here on the Cape, right? But we'll see them once in a while in the Mashpee area or something.
They nest over in Lakeville in southeastern Mass, but some of the ponds, Mashpee Wakeby Pond, had the last few winters, there's been, I don't know, six or seven bald eagles wintering on the Cape. Young ones are floating around all the time, and you just sort of have to be lucky. If you're on a beach and you see all the gulls get up, if a dog didn't do it, they're responding to a bald eagle. Where I live over on Nantucket, I have a great view of the dump. And whenever I'm looking out there and I see all the gulls get up, I know there's an eagle out there, so I go out with the binocs and I usually find an eagle soaring around over the dump. You just sort of have to be lucky, but eagles are much more common here in the winter, and the colder it gets, the better a chance of seeing an adult. Right. If it really freezes up, because lots of eagles come down from eastern Canada and Maine, some winters there'll be upwards of 20 bald eagles on the Cape.
All right, so, Mike, we're going to look for that photo when you find that bald eagle.
Yeah, you'll get one.
Thanks, Mike. Thanks for the phone call. All right, Rosalind's calling from Falmouth. Hi, Rosalind.
Hi. I have a question about a herring gull. He caught a 5 or 6 inch little fish. I thought it was going to fly off with it, but it kept picking it up in its beak and dropping it, and picking it up and dropping it, and it kept doing this, and I couldn't figure out why. And maybe after about a dozen times or so, he did start to peck it, just peck it occasionally. Finally, it looked like he maybe broke through the skin. I really didn't know what was happening and was starting to eat something. And then the next minute I look, it's halfway down its gullet, and it was gone. So I was wondering, why would it keep picking it up and dropping it? Was it trying to kill it, or what was happening?
I think that's exactly right. A lot of times, do you know what kind of fish it was?
No, it was silvery. It was, I can't remember.
Well, if it was, some fish have, almost all fish have a lot of spines, and, their dorsal fins they can erect. So if they're alive and the gull's trying to swallow it, they'll erect those spines and puncture the esophagus or puncture something in the gull. So it tried to swallow it and realized, wait a minute, this is a bad idea. And so it sounds like it basically pecked it to death. And then when it died, it swallowed it.
Yeah.
That would be my guess. Right. So it's not very pleasant for the fish, but
birds gotta eat.
It's tough out there. Yeah.
Rosalind, thanks for the phone call. If you have a bird question or a bird story you'd like to share with us, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is birdnews@capeandislands.org. Georgette says she remembers hearing about those European lapwings this spring on the show, and she wants to know if they stayed around.
The northern lapwings from Europe and Asia were an amazing special. They showed up on Nantucket, two of them, on October 30th, a day after Superstorm Sandy went whistling inland, and this jet stream of 60-mile-an-hour wind coming from France to here happened, and over a dozen lapwings arrived in North America, which was unprecedented, at least in the last 100 years. The two of them stayed all winter. A third bird joined them in March for a couple of weeks. And then this pair on Nantucket, they started courting. They do these spectacular flights where they go up and they tumble out of the sky. They were amazing. And I last saw them on April Fool's Day. And I couldn't have April 2nd, no. April 3rd, no. And then they weren't seen again. They were gone. Yeah. There were a couple seen in late April. One bird showed up in sort of central Massachusetts. One was seen in Ontario. But we don't know if they went. I'm assuming they went back to Europe. I was convinced they were going to stay a nest on Nantucket.
Yeah, you were hoping.
But, I know, but I was a little too optimistic. Yeah, it didn't happen. Well. But thanks for the question.
Again, a reminder: our Bird Brain Quiz question this month is what bird has the song mnemonic "Whoops, three beers"? Whoops, three beers. Am I doing that right?
Quick, three beers.
Yeah. Okay. There you go. That's a good hint. All right. And we got a question here about hummingbirds. When do hummingbirds leave? And how long should we leave out those feeders?
Hummingbirds are leaving right now. In fact, this week is about the peak of the hummingbird migration in the fall. As far as feeders out, people ask me that. The hummingbirds are they're highly migratory. They're instinctually, they're going to leave anyway. And I would encourage people to leave their hummingbird feeders up because
sometimes a couple hang around.
Well, and what's been happening since just in the last decade, we've started to learn that hummingbirds show up here in late, like even right now, if something comes to your feeder, it may not be a ruby-throated hummingbird. There's a rufous hummingbird that nests all the way up in Alaska and winters down in Central America. It turns out in the fall, a lot of the late hummingbirds, in fact, any hummingbird after the third week of September is more likely not to be a ruby throat, but a stray from the west. Mm. So, and these birds will use the feeders, and hopefully they'll just fatten up and stay a week or so and take off. Occasionally, some of these hummingbirds, they're really sort of lost. They're thousands of miles from where they want to be, and we have had rufous hummingbirds and some other species actually overwinter on the Cape. And some of these hummingbird feeder people are very dedicated. If they get a hummingbird that stays the winter, then they figure out, It becomes a big responsibility. Right. You can't let the feeder freeze. They worry about the little. So
keep them up, and then
you don't want to deal with it.
What about the other feeders? Are we putting up the?
If you're going to feed birds, it's a big responsibility, really, because once you start, you really have to make a commitment to do it from now through April, because once the birds that are migrating by are just going to come and feed. Birds that are arriving here, which aren't really here yet for the winter, will find your feeders, and that's going to be part of their wintering range, and they're going to depend on that food. So if you're going to Florida for the month of February,
don't feed
unless you're going to have someone stay at your house and feed the, and especially the time they really need the feeders is when there's a big snowstorm or when you least want to go out and fill them is when the birds need it the most. So before
it's
you start,
it's worth the commitment.
Think about it, and like even if you go away, you have to have someone come and fill your feeders.
When we had that big snow, Bob, wore snowshoes out to the bird feeders.
You gotta go out.
But it's great. I mean, you just don't know what you're going to see. Like the year I had the yellow-breasted chat.
I think it's very exciting. It's entertaining. You can learn a lot, and it's and you're helping. I think you're helping the birds.
Exactly. All right. Let's talk to Terry calling from Mashpee. Hi, Terry.
Hi. I'm a bit of a newbie, but I enjoy woodpeckers quite a bit, and I try to attract them. And of course, where I am, I see lots of the common downy and hairy, and sometimes occasionally get a treat with the red-bellied, which is great, the color. But what's the likelihood of seeing a red-headed woodpecker around the Cape? I know we're in their range, but are they common around here?
No, red-headed woodpeckers are sort of an accidental migrant. I can't remember the last time a red-headed woodpecker spent the winter on the Cape Announced. The best time to find them is from now, actually early October. They're more of a bird of the Midwest. In fact, they're really rare anywhere in Massachusetts. There was one pair nesting in Danvers, Mass. But as far as I know, there are no red-headed woodpeckers nesting in Massachusetts, even in New England right now. Mm. But in the fall, when the northwest winds, sometimes we get they'll show up at coastal at spots like Gay Head or Woods Hole, and they're very when they fly, they have these gigantic white where there's nothing that looks like a red-headed woodpecker on the wing. With their woodpeckers undulate as they fly, and these have these really crazy white wing patches. I think last fall I saw three immature red-headed woodpeckers flying by out on Nantucket. Hmm. So you probably don't have much of a chance of seeing one unless you go down to like Morris Island and Chatham every morning, or I don't know where you live.
Mashpee.
You live in Mashpee? Yeah. Do you check? There's a website called massbird.org, and all people report their sightings on there. And if a red-headed woodpecker is seen, it will certainly show up on Massbird, and you could maybe go try to chase it.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you're probably not going to see one here. But that's okay. Mm-hmm. I'm glad you're enjoying the other ones.
Yeah.
Woodpeckers are very cool. They're like vivacious, noisy, and that's great.
All right, Terry, thanks for the call. Before we get to the other calls, I want to give our bird brain quiz answer before we run out of time. And our question was, what bird has the song mnemonic, whoops, three beers? And it is the... Oh, here we go. Uh-oh.
I heard it. I love this call. Olive-sided flycatcher is a big flycatcher.
Yeah.
And they nest up in spruce bogs, actually out in western Mass, but further north. And they winter south of the equator in South America, a long-distance migrant. Right now, the next few weeks are the best time to see them on the Cape and Islands, although they're not going to be doing this call probably. Okay, although they do that other call.
All right, let's try Barbara in South Yarmouth. Hi, Barbara.
Hi. You were mentioning about bird stories.
Yep.
We have a memory that we treasure. I went to college at Michigan State University, and in front of the building that I went to, there was a large oval driveway with crabapple trees, an orchard of them down the center. When the right time of year came, the fruit would ripen and then ferment and fall and on the ground, and we'd get large flocks of cedar waxwings who would come and eat the fruit, which was not a problem, except they'd get drunk. And they'd start rolling around the lawn and the driveway and flapping, and some of them were just lying there. And if you drove into the school driveway, you'd have to be very careful at that time of year that you didn't run over the cedar waxwings.
Oh, my.
Because they were having such a good time with the crabapple fruit.
Yeah, that's a good one, Barbara. We've heard stories like that before. Vern, that's what they're doing, right? Fermented fruit?
Oh, yeah. They, They're incredible. I once was in Juneau, Alaska, right before Christmas, and every crabapple tree had Bohemian waxwings, and they were just flopping around on the ground. They were so drunk. Every cat in town was walking around with a waxwing in its mouth. It was
That's a bad story.
I'll never forget that.
Barbara, thanks for the call. We've got only about 45 seconds, so we better get to our bird song of the month, which is this little bird right here that we're going to hear.
This, you're going to hear it if you go out at dusk now, or if a calm right at sunset and again at dawn. You'll hear these all over the Cape and the Vineyard. There are no screech owls on Nantucket.
And these screech owls readily accept nesting boxes, and they'll use bird baths to drink and bathe in.
Instead of a nesting box, they actually will roost in a box. If you build, you can easily go online and find a plan for a screech owl box. And the whole thing is to mount it so that squirrels cannot get into it. Right. And you stand a very good chance of getting screech owls.
All right. I'm Indy Todd, along with ornithologist Vernon Locks.
Until next time, keep your eyes to the sky.
Bird News is produced by Amy Vince, with production assistance from Steve Junker and Jenny Junker. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Theme music is Harvest Time by Mike Marshall and Chris Thiele, and is courtesy of Sugar Hill Records. Bird News is a production of WCAI, the Cape and Islands NPR station, a service of WGBH Radio.